Russia has been developing as the military organization of the Russian people. And when we forgot about this, then we crumbled. Now we are strengthening this again, and it's required by the circumstances. But there is a problem that needs to be thought of. So we've got 80% of our GDP goes to defense. This is much less than in Soviet Union. In Soviet Union, we don't know how much was spent because this was not public information. But we spent a lot of money to support socialist countries, their socialist orientation. Of course, it was kind of imposed, and there was a mixture of political and military budget. However, we should win this war sooner or later, and through decisive means, maybe within the next 2 years. Do we have a plan of conversion with companies? I remember the horrible experience of the 90s when we threw away the highly technological millions of very valuable employees with brains. Maybe now we have to create these plans of conversion when we start to reduce military spending. In the 90s, we not just spent, we destroyed the potential. And I remember this, and I know this very well, because I worked here in St. Petersburg, and 70% of the economy of the city was represented by the defense sector. We've demolished or destroyed all of it, or almost all of it. And at the beginning of the 2000s, we started to work on reestablishing all of that, and we managed to do this with a great element of highly technological element. And of course, we need to think about conversion, not just the conversion. We need to think about the fact that these facilities have to developed in a modern way. What do I mean? Throughout the whole world, those companies that produce military products and military equipment, they also produce civilian equipment and products. And that's, they're very successful in terms of attracting these new technologies. And generally, we have a plan. And this plan is being followed through. Last year, the level of defense sector manufacturing was in the region of 25%, 25.1%, I think, in 2022. Last year, this was in the region of 30%, almost 29%. So we've got that process. And of course, we have to think about the fact that our military spending has to correspond with the demands of today and with the level of development of our economy. We should not be doing what they're doing in the United States, because their trade deficit, the current account deficit, is $1 trillion a year. What does that mean? I think it will be clear what I'm talking about here. This is exactly the neo-colonialism in its modern edition. Using the monopoly position of the dollar, United States are consuming $1 trillion goods more a year than they produce. So they are sucking it out of the other countries. So we talked about this pandemic years. I can't remember how much they printed. I think they printed in the region of $5 trillion. And in Europe, they printed about 3.4 trillion euro. So what did they do? They gave this paper away to other countries, and then they started to buy up food on the markets, just like a Hoover, like a vacuum cleaner, sucking it all in. And so they became net importers. Net importers. And so the food prices have gone up throughout the world straight away. We cannot behave like this. We don't have this monopoly for the national currency like in the US. And we have never behaved like this, like colonialists. In this case, we have to rely on our economy and be realistic. And this is what we're doing. When we are balancing the situation in our economy, we're thinking about, for the future, of course, we are thinking about diversification. I've got another question to do with economy. I think these questions are very pressing for everyone a lot of people in the audience. So we've got that certain measures we know that now the mistakes that were done in the in privatization were very significant, and of course there was a lot of corruption. However, now we see that there's a kind of we're rolling back some of this, but where are the boundaries of this? If we're saying that we're trying to correct the mistakes that were done in the 90s, they were all mistakes because everything was done illegally. In every case, things were done illegally, and I remember I had to deal with all those processes. Because I had to somehow manage the institute that I was ahead of, and science did not pay at the time, and I know what privatization was. We see now that the private capital is currently very, very flexible in filling up certain niches. And we see that the private capital is doing a lot of things that could not be done by the state economy. Maybe we should just ban export of capital, and the KPI for the governors should be based on the level of protection of private property. As for resources, they are the property of the state. In any case, subsoil is the property of the states, and it's given to companies for use. As for the criminal privatization of the 90s, as painful as it is for me, I don't think we should be using those adjectives. I don't think that this was done purposefully in a criminal way. Yes, in a lot of cases, there were lots of mistakes. And there are some economists, some Russian economists, who were saying that everything had to be privatized as quickly as possible, even if only $1 is paid for it. The most important thing, they were saying is that assets should move to hands of people who can use those assets, and government or state could not do that, they were saying. But as it turned out, that this was not the right approach for maximum efficiency. And it turned out that the government can be a very efficient owner, especially in the industries which require large investments. Because at that time, nobody had investment. And that's where all these shady schemes appeared. All this false privatization, in actual fact, it was just the theft of state property. People would just take out loans, and they would buy the state asset, and then they would work and pay out of that asset. They would pay out the loan. You know, sometimes you'd not even pay out the loan. This is not correct from the economic point of view. The prosecutors only deal with criminal privatization of government property. But, of course, you are right that there should be some restricting lines, some common sense boundaries. And we've been discussing this with the business and with the society. I think that all of this has to be done not at the level of the decrees of the president or the government, but it has to be in law. And we're discussing this in with colleagues, and I think we will come to some sort of conclusion, decision. Thank you. Now we'll move to political questions. You talk about your desire to conduct negotiations in relation to finishing up the conflict in Ukraine. And of course, that desire is very commendable. But who do we negotiate it with? Our Western partners have cheated us, deceived us many times, and they have went back on many agreements that we've achieved with them. The Kiev regime is morally illegitimate, politically illegitimate, and even legally illegitimate. It's a failed state. How can you negotiate at all with them without destroying them first, without defeating them first? And or if you just put a nuclear pistol to the heads of our Western opponents and force them to negotiate. As Stalin said, I don't have any other writers. Well, there was a union of writers of the USSR, and Beria came with reports against them, and Stalin said, well, I don't have any other writers. So these are the partners that we have. We don't have any other partners. We have to try to achieve agreements or conditions which would go along with our interests. And you're right that they are saying one thing and they're doing something else. They're not fulfilling their obligations. But all military conflicts end in peaceful agreements. However, as one of the former heads of European states, former heads of European states told me, is that these agreements are made on the basis of either a military win or a military loss. And we, of course, are aiming at a military win. The question of legitimacy of those who we negotiate with. Of course, there's a problem. The current power that even a brief analysis of the Constitution of Ukraine says that there's Article 3 of Constitution of Ukraine in 73, Article 73, which says that even executive has lost its legitimacy. They're saying that in the Constitution says that Rada's, Verkhovna Rada, authority can be Ukrainian parliament can be extended, their power can be extended, but in terms of president, nothing is said. But as for so it says that during it doesn't say that during the martial law the presidential elections are not held. It says that they are prolonged. So we say that we know that if it doesn't specifically say this, doesn't specifically provide for this, it doesn't allow it. The law does not allow it to do without the presidential elections. I think in accordance with Article 110, 111, I think the authority moves to the Speaker of the Parliament. So if negotiations need to be done, then we can find somebody to negotiate with. And we started negotiations in Minsk and then in Istanbul. And even if we take those agreements that were achieved in Istanbul, we need to they need to be based on the reality of today. All the wars end in negotiations, but also all the wars finish in capitulation of surrender of the enemy. So in these conditions where America benefits from this war, they will continue slaughtering Ukrainians. This war, without moving up that military escalation, cannot end. It cannot be finished without escalating it in a nuclear way. There will be lots of conflicts that will appear objectively. Of course, there is a nuclear fuse which has weakened significantly. There's a fear of nuclear weapons. Do we understand that we have a responsibility not just to win this war, but we also have to be much harder in terms of nuclear escalation? We have to use this nuclear fuse in order to stop the further escalation. Who can do this other than you? You've got great responsibility on you. And if we creep up this ladder, and it's happening anyway, I think then that means we're moving away from that responsibility. You're moving away from that responsibility. In terms of nuclear escalation, we've never started this rhetoric. I can't remember that lady. She was the Prime Minister of United Kingdom. When she became Prime Minister, she said that she was prepared to press the nuclear button. We never said this. We never said this. And this is where it all began. We're responded to this, that you have to be more serious about this, and we never brandish our nuclear weapons. And application or non-application of nuclear weapons. We've got a nuclear doctrine, and it's all in there. I spoke with these heads of these information agencies. I said that everything is written there. The application of these weapons can be... It's an exceptional case where territorial integrity of the Russian Federation is threatened. I don't think we've got that exceptional case yet. However, we are very carefully monitoring what's happening in the world with us and around us. And we accept the possibility that we would introduce some changes into this military doctrine. As for agreement on this was signed and ratified. Americans never ratified, and we've recalled that ratification. That's on testing the nuclear weapons. And if we need to, we will revoke that ratification. As for the speed and the results, you said that there's a great responsibility on me. Yes, that's true. We can increase the speed of resolving the issues that we have ahead of us. However, that's in direct proportion with the level of losses. And what is being proposed by the Chief General and Ministry of Defense is very important. However, what's more important is taking care of lives and health of our guys that are fighting in the, at the front line. There's military work that is being done since the start. Since the start of this year, we've liberated 47 villages and towns. 870 square kilometers have been liberated. We are pushing out the enemy from the territory. And the General Staff, Ministry of Defense have got certain plans, and we're confident that they will be implemented, that they will be realized. Nevertheless, we understand that nuclear escalation can save lots of lives because it can bring sense back to our enemies. We've got this nuclear doctrine, and I'm sure that it will be changed. Will be changed in the nearest future, and you will have the right. You will have the right, you will receive the right to respond with a nuclear strike against any strike, any type of strike against our country. And this is the right of our head of state, should be the right of head of state. And I think that change in our doctrine will cool down the heads of our enemies. Maybe it's too early to go towards nuclear escalation. However, our enemies have gone crazy. Like Americans are more careful. They're feeding Ukrainians to these meat grinders, and the Europeans are going to this war the third time. They're going against us. So, if a pack of dogs or hyenas attacks you, and you've got a stick, you can use it to scare them away. But maybe they will tear your trousers and then bite your legs and then will eat you. But if you can shoot a couple of them, then they will run away. President Mnangagwa maybe knows how to deal with hyenas. Do you agree with me that is the way you deal with hyenas? No, we've got our own. We've got our own in Europe. So I'd like to maybe reiterate this question. If we are more decisive in terms of escalation, maybe God showed us the path. Sodom and Gomorrah were destroyed. And that story is there through that fire rain. They were destroyed. So maybe that part of humanity that lost its belief in God and also lost its mind now. Maybe we could do this without me. They're scared now. Look at this. And of course, maybe we can think about Europeans. Anything is possible. If, God forbid, it goes to certain strikes, we have to understand. We have early notification systems. We've got that. Nowhere else in the world do they have that system, early notification system. So they're defenseless in this sense. That's number one. Second is the power of the strikes. Our tactical nuclear weapons is 3-4 times more powerful than what Americans used against Hiroshima and Nagasaki. In terms of numbers, we've got several fold more. Even if the Americans bring things to Europe, we've got several times more. But if, God forbid, this comes to this, then you said we will reduce the victims. However, they could also rise to infinity. Also, these Europeans will have to think if those with whom we are exchanging these strikes, if Americans get involved on a strategic level, I doubt very much. I think Europeans should think about it. I doubt that Americans will get involved. But I'm confident that it will never come to this, and we do not have that need for this. Our military are gaining experience, they are gaining competence, our military-industrial complex is demonstrating its efficiency. I spoke about this many times. I think we've increased the production of ammunition by 20 times. We are manifold greater in terms of our capabilities, in terms of aviation. We are significantly stronger in terms of tanks and so on and so forth. So we don't even have the need to think about this. So I just would like to ask you not to mention this unnecessarily. You are so responsible, and however, we're dealing with somebody who is very irresponsible and who lost their minds. You're a scary person. We are looking at these partners from outside, and I grew up in their system. It just happened for me like that. I know them from the early age. And I understand very well. And I support your hesitation, because this is a very scary choice. And this is a choice that needs to be done in the in very difficult conditions. However, if they know that you're not going to make that choice, they're going to endlessly continue. And they are fighting not just against us. They are fighting against our friends, majority in the world. Because we are the core of strategic core. If they manage to turn us, then a lot of the other world will turn. I don't know if presidents agree with me. Let me say something. My decisions and the decisions of my colleagues, people I work with in this respect, they're not connected to hesitations. There are no hesitations, and there can never be any hesitations. All our decisions have to be made based on analysis, on real analysis of the current situation. And this is what we're doing. The day before yesterday, you spoke to foreign agencies, and you said something very interesting. You said that we can supply we can supply to the enemies of our enemies. We can supply the weapons, long-range weapons. And I think I was very happy to hear that, because it's high time we did this. Hypersonic weapons. And especially if we supply that together with our technical experts, this will improve the situation in the world. People will just... So what are we going to supply? I understand that we will not be doing this ourselves yet, but... As for aircraft carriers, they're not pointless from the point of view of geopolitical influence. As a tool, you can move them further towards the territory where Americans or French or British want to fight or force somebody. They make sense. However, provided taking into account hypersonic weapons that China and Russia have, they of course lose sense, and they should not be spending their money. What did you say? They should not be spending the money. They should be spending. Don't say this out loud. Let them continue spending the money. So, as a strategic weapon, aircraft carriers have lost their meaning. But as a non-strategic weapon, they still make sense. Let them spend the money on it. As for supply of weapons, we are not supplying weapons yet, but we reserve the right to do this. And to states and legal structures that experience certain pressure, including military pressure from countries that supply weapons to Ukraine and call for use of that weapons against our Russian territory. If they supply weapons to the military action area and call for its use, why can't we do the same thing? Why can't we mirror what they're doing there? But to say that we're going to do this tomorrow, I'm not prepared to say that, because in any case, this such supply is connected with a number of things, number of circumstances, which influence certain regions of the world, and we have to think carefully. So we're finishing up with the military, unpleasant military part. In order to attack, if we go according to what I insist on, this fast escalation, I think we need to raise the topic of mobilization, at least partial mobilization. Do you think using mobilization, without mobilization, can we defeat the enemy? Or do we need mobilization? If we follow the recommendations that you voiced to do this at maximum speed, of course, the current military is not sufficient. However, we've got a different tactics. We're pushing out the enemy out of the territory that we want to have under our control. In this case, we have no need for mobilization, and we're not planning for that. Mobilization that we had 300,000 people drafted, but last year, without any mobilization, volunteers, our men, our people who are patriotic, voluntarily came to drafting units. They signed contracts. There were in excess of 300,000 people. This year, since the start of the year, the drafting points had over 160,000 people come and sign the contracts. So we've got 1,000 people coming almost every day. When we see what the Russian character is, what character of a Russian person is, when we understand this and we rely on this, we don't need any nuclear weapons to finish a conflict. I'd like to add only that we see this forced mobilization in Ukraine. Of course, I'm confident that the age of mobilization will reduce. We know for sure that Americans have put up a condition to lower the age of mobilization to 23, to 20, and then to 18. Or maybe just go to 18 straight away. So this is not our business. Of course, then they will replace all the current heads of state in Ukraine. So they, I think, 70,000 they had about 2 months ago, and then 50 last month. So there is a reduction. What they are drafting and what they will continue to draft goes just to replace their losses. There will be some addition. We can count it in different ways. I don't want to go into figures, but we understand the figures. And in the current situation, where we've got volunteers coming in and go to fight for their motherland, we don't need to talk about mobilization. Naturally, I understand your point, but I understand the history of our country very well. And I remember 2016 when and 1916, and people were tired. And in 17, we took out the victory out of the hands of loss. Now, when we have got this surge of the spirit of Russian people and economy is strong, we can work. So we've got this fifth column that ran away. Our Western partners are liquidating their own, people who are on their side among our ranks. So these are the arguments that we send you on a regular basis, where we thank you for your recommendations. We're not dismissing anything. We're taking everything into account. So there's a point that you've already touched upon. So we grew up in this communist ideology, and we don't want that. However, a great state without a great idea, without a great ideology, cannot exist. Those countries that lost the national idea, they perished, and there's lots of shadows or graves of such states. By the way, we did this too when we lost our belief in Tsar and our motherland, and then the second time we lost it when we lost faith in communism. Now we talk about this ideology. State ideology can be formulated very well, and you've partly formulated it in your speeches. Maybe this ideology should not be compulsory, but it should be compulsory at least for those people who want to become leaders of the country, who want to be the elite of the country. So it's like a code of honor, and it can be formulated easily. And it's very close to the Confucian ideal decent man, and also can be based on some orthodox principles, Muslim principles. So if people want to just lead ordinary life, that's fine. But if you want to lead, if you want to achieve success in society, then you have to stick to very clear rules, and these rules should be formulated. So this can be done quite easily, but I don't want to maybe do this in this audience right now. Why are we afraid of this? Why are we afraid to introduce a single ideology for the state, for those who want to serve the state and the society? We're not afraid of anything. We're afraid of it. There's constitution that you mentioned, and it says that that there should not be any dominant ideology. We did have an ideology during Soviet times. However, the presence of that ideology did not prevent the collapse of the Soviet Union. So the idea, unifying idea, should be there, of course. You said that, first of all, we lost our faith in Tsar and motherland, and then we lost faith in communism. We did lose faith in Tsar, but we did not lose faith in motherland. Secondly, there were different ideas about what is good and what is bad for motherland, and that's a different question. The faith in communism was lost. No, it not by everyone. Otherwise, we would not have had a communist party right now. And we respect that very much. The idea is that we have to have unifying ideas. And today's events demonstrate this, that it's patriotism in a very good sense of the word. People who come to the front line without trying to preserve their life or health, this is the demonstration of patriotism. So this is something that we have to present in a nice way, and we have to explain this in a beautiful way. Please help us with that. Yes, we will do that. I remember this communist ideology, and we lost that communist ideology. I did not miss it very much. However, because of the death of that ideology, we lost the country, because there was a vacuum, and that vacuum had to be filled. So this vacuum has to be filled. If you offer us something, then we will do it. But then you will have to propose this to the society, to the elite, and make that compulsory. And then it will work. And our communist ideology was compulsory for everyone. And for many years, it moved our country ahead. And that allowed us to win this horrible war. You know, I it would be a pleasure to discuss this with you, but I don't want to move this into this grave field. But if this was the only thing that unified the multi-ethnic country, then that would be one thing. However, why did they legalize the church again? And it's the same way today. They're saying that there are no people, non-believers in the trenches. There are no non-believers in the trenches. And it was this exactly the same at that time. And because of that belief, they came and they moved forward. And so Motherland was number one always. And please, let's not forget this. Of course. However, many countries did collapse when they lost their national ideology. Okay, maybe let's talk about another peaceful question. We've got great discussion in the country about immigration. And there are some chauvinistic moods which are lethal for a multi-ethnic society like ours. With this, police department is the one that's dealing with immigration. Whether they're doing it well or not is another matter, but their objective is to limit the immigration. I think that there should be a much harder approach in terms of limiting negative influences. And maybe we could start the process of attracting highly qualified migrants. So there will be a crisis migration, and it's happening now. We missed a wave of very interesting people who could have come from Afghanistan when they were fleeing, when Americans did what they did there recently. Maybe we should modernize our policy of migration policy. It's too liberal at the moment. And at the moment, it's the police department that's dealing with immigration. Maybe the government should create a body that will regulate us. Maybe we could develop modern concept of or modern migration policy and deal with it. I've got nothing against this. You're right. In terms of interesting people from Afghanistan, we need to think about this. We've got lots of interesting people from other countries. But you are right now that this conscious. We do not have that conscious migration policy. We had a body which was then absorbed by the Ministry of Internal Affairs. And so we've got this question. So we're discussing this with colleagues, and I put this in front of the government and the Security Council to come back to this question as soon as possible. We can't say that this problem is not there. It's there. We have to have labor migration with this zero unemployment. Lack of labor becomes a limiting factor. But also, it's important that we need not just migrants, but we need people with certain background, certain qualification. My colleagues understand this. My colleagues from the countries where we've got majority of immigration from understand this, and we together should agree with them how we prepare them in terms of knowledge of our laws, our language, and so on, so that these people who come also feel comfortable, so that locals do not have any problem with that in their daily life. Because migrants, where do they accumulate? They accumulate in areas where there's economic growth, in St. Petersburg, in Moscow, in some Siberian country cities. Of course, we have to do a lot in that field. I would like to use the experience of our distinguished guest. I'd like to ask President of Bolivia. I will ask my colleagues to distribute your speech as a study material for everyone in my university, because this is a live example of what we teach at our universities. This is a live example, real life example of an alternative. But I've got a different question. You are relatively rich country, and you need to maybe attract investments, and you've got plans for transcontinental channel. So will you need to go to the World Bank or IMF, or is the time gone for this? Do you need new instruments? What sort of instruments do you see? So we're creating BRICS Bank, for example. What would be ideal from your point of view, from an effective acting economist? What would be the ideal system which will give you the opportunity to develop in an independent way? As for the possible loss of certain elements of the European culture and genes of the European culture in Russia, because we're turning towards the East and towards Asia. First of all, we're not turning because of some change in the mood today. This change, this turn is happening in the world, globally, due to growth of new centers of economic development. And we started this work long before the tragic events that are happening in Ukraine. I said this right at the beginning, that the economy is shrinking and the influence of the previous centers of influence is shrinking, is reducing. So we see that the BRICS GDP is greater than the total GDP of the Big Seven. And these trends not just continue, these trends also speed up and they increase. This is an inevitable flow of events. You can't do anything with it. This is a trend. This is a trend that will continue. And of course, as we just discussed with you, Peter's created a window to Europe because it was the center of economic development and culture and so on. And then he was presenting the boots that were made in Holland and so on. But and we have to take into account these elements. And as for the genes of European culture, it's not us who are losing these genes. It's the parts of the Western Europe that are losing these genes of European culture themselves. What will remain is just architecture. This culture is being poisoned by globalists who put as their priority not local interests of their people. They put as the basis their ideas that are removed from reality. So in this sense, we are becoming the center of traditional European culture and the center of traditional European values. If you look back into the centuries, even for non-believers, these values are based overall on Christian culture. For us, for Russia, for a country with many confessions, I can't remember who said this, but that the state is the military machine for the Russian people. I disagree with this, because we are a multi-confession state. If you think about Catherine and other heads of states, tsars and emperors, they always treated local populations with respect. They always treated local traditions with respect. This is how Russia was formed. And part of the Russian culture is European culture. And we became the bearers of this culture. And in their own countries, they're killing their own culture. And of course, we see that now certain Europeans do understand the value of it, and they do try to come back to their traditional values, but whether they manage to do this or not, we'll have to see. From our side, what we need to do is we need to develop our country on the basis of the historic roots on which it was formed as a multi-ethnic, multi-confessional state. And you said about St. Petersburg. Yes, it's exactly what we're doing. We are developing culture here. We are cooperating with our friends and partners from Europe, from Asia, from Latin America, from Africa. You talked about St. Petersburg. I look at the picture on the left, on the right, in the middle of this picture. Isakiev Cathedral, Synod. This is a view from the university where I studied. So we've got Menshikov Palace, and then we've got Vasilievsky Island, Isakiev. So this is a view from Hermitage. If you look back from this side to the 12th collegium, it would be as beautiful. Why is that? Why? Because all of this is done on the basis of a very important principle, a principle of harmony. We will be building our policy on that basis, harmony. Russia will definitely be part of that multipolar, harmonious world. And it's natural for us that we will rely on our European roots, European culture, but we will treat the traditions and cultures of other ethnicities of the Russian Federation with as much respect. Thank you. I would like to thank our guests and our chairman. Thank you.